the setup you'd like. I mean, just stick with the stuff you're well known for.
Yeah, just do a quick one. I'll do also. I have a quick intro slide.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Hey, by the way, thank you.
Oh, it's great. I like this talk. It's fun because it brings together people who aren't. It's not just a pure academic conference, it's also not a firewall vendor confab.
Yeah. Sort of halfway, midpoint between RSA and crypto, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's actually fun because people get kind of, it's, you know, sort of used this tradition where people get fired up and fire back and forth.
Yeah, I think I'm going to. Got a couple slides on DRM stuff.
That'll get people's blood up with that.
I think that might happen a little. Is there a clock somewhere, or should I just use this?
You want to borrow my watch?
No, it's fine. There's just there's one out.
So, welcome to this afternoon's invited talk. Today we have Paul Kotcher, who's going to be talking about surviving Moore's Law. I think Paul is known for his aggressive work in cryptography and in constructions, and certainly in applied cryptography, as well as someone who actually was able to mount or did the background to be able to mount real timing attacks on algorithms such as RSA, and it's had a profound effect on the environment, on the systems community. He's also known for his work in things like being one of the co-authors of SSL v3. And has done a lot for the community in developing protocols. So I guess I probably won't go on at length. I will just turn it over to Paul and say thank you for having a talk.
Thanks, Patrick. So today's talk, I'm going to sort of have some fun looking at what the trend of Moore's Law means for us. And I think everybody here has this sense that of doom. And I'm going to look a little bit at why we have that sense and what the good, solid reasons for it are, and then some of the things that both on commercial systems that I work on as well as research that we're doing to try to get some kind of sense of control. And I'll sort of walk through a couple of different directions of solving the problem and try to wrap them together at the end. In terms of background, I was trained as a biologist who ended up in cryptography because Marty Hellman retired and sent me some wonderful consulting projects, which started my company back in about 1995. And today I've got run a company in San Francisco. We do work that walks the line between academic research and applied problems. So everything we work on has an applied component to it, but it's also going to be a problem where there isn't some kind of a existing solution that works. Some of the things that I've worked on, and I'll talk about a few of them here, include things like some hardware constructs for building very highly tamper-resistant chips. Built a system a few years ago for brute-forcing DES. I'll talk about that a little bit. Helped design and did most of the design work on SSL3, which I think is the most widely used protocol for communicating between insecure computers in the world, and many other things as well. Could just start with just a very quick historical look at cryptography and security. So the first sort of real book on what I would sort of consider sort of the first hints of modern cryptography was De Furtivis Literarum Notus in 1563. And from there till about the mechanical machines around the turn of the century, it's mostly sort of pencil and paper codes. The German Enigma, even the US M209 and the other sort of related mechanical machines, all were designed with a sort of single-minded focus or obsession on trying to defeat cryptanalysis because computation was extraordinarily expensive. And if you're having to use a code wheel like this by hand to encrypt a long message, or use an M209 or an Enigma, any of these sorts of devices are hard to use, and the amount of computation that you can do is extremely limited inside of there. Which meant that for a long time, the sort of binary concept of security could really come down to the question of whether you were beating cryptanalysis or not. And then all of this changed in about 1980. So 1980 was about the point where cryptographers beat cryptanalysts. And sort of the last hurrah of cryptanalysis, as I see it from a sort of pure mathematical perspective, was the deep crack machine that we built for breaking DES keys. And the reason I call this sort of the last hurrah of conventional cryptanalysis is that the DES key length was 56 bits, which means that you've got about 72 million billion keys. Big number, but you can test them all if you have enough hardware. But the margin of victory from the algorithm designer perspective increases over time. So when I go from DES to triple DES, I take three times as much computation power from the encryption side, but the attacker effort gets squared. So by doing this relatively modest increase in the defender's effort, I get this absolutely tremendous improvement in security against this particular class of attack. So this is about where the optimistic part of my presentation ends, because the notion here is that we're getting better and better security over time. And this complexity is driving that and making this possible is being driven by Moore's law. One of the interesting things about this slide is you can pretty much plot it at any starting point and any ending point, and you get, as predicted, this exponential increase in complexity. So if you take Intel's CPUs, the number of millions of transistors in them doubles approximately every 18 months, give or take a little bit. And if you sort of extend this out to sort of the current CPUs, we're well beyond a billion transistors. Likewise, the number of lines of code in Microsoft's operating systems is growing at a similar pace. And as a security person, we then have this problem that we have to be able to understand and synthesize all of these systems and figure out, okay, what are the vulnerabilities and what are the problems? And at the we have this growth in the systems that we're studying, we don't have a corresponding improvement in our intelligence. So we can't possibly keep up with this with the current approaches that we're using. One of the reasons that this is such an important issue for security is that insecurity is an emergent property. So if I take a chunk of x86 assembler, I know what every one of these instructions is documented as doing. I understand the instruction. I know what it will do to the registers. If I'm really sophisticated, I can go look at the timing and other things and potentially completely understand this piece of code. But that intuition that I have that I can therefore understand code doesn't apply in the slightest when you look at a very large quantity of code because of these kinds of emergent properties. It's a lot like if you're looking at ants and trying to understand colonies, or looking at the TCP/IP protocol and trying to understand how the internet works based on that. So we get this false impression that we understand the system because we understand the individual components. I'm now going to talk a little bit about why insecurity emerges as complexity increases, and then the rest of the slide I'll look at some of the techniques that we can use for designing and defending and sort of coping with this. When I think of security, I think of it as one end of a spectrum. And at the other end, we have functionality, and in the middle, we have reliability. And there's overlap between these that sort of sits in each of the different places there. So functionality really boils down to getting correct operation in typical circumstances. When I type a letter into my word processor, hit print, and the letter comes out on a piece of paper, that is a very functional driven sort of process. And unexpected functionality in there is great. It's fine. I mean, if there's an extra feature in that word processor, maybe it'll come in handy, so long as it doesn't stop me from what I want to do. And typically, functionality tolerates bugs in proportion to complexity. So if I've got a product with 500 features in it and 1% don't work because they're buggy, unless they're in the really critical things that I need, it's still quite likely a very useful product. Reliability is trying to get correct operation in all naturally occurring situations. And for security, we're taking it to all maliciously chosen situations. So we are expanding the set of possible environments where a system has to operate correctly. And obviously, as you all know, a defect in, for example, send mail and some feature that nobody ever uses in the real world is absolutely fatal from a security perspective. Now, the reason that this is a really nasty problem for us as security people is that all of engineering is built around this concept of abstraction, which is really the notion that you can hide complexity of systems under nice, clean layers, or somebody who's working above the layer of abstraction doesn't have to fully understand what's going on underneath. So you end up then with the little minutiae, the details of the security system being hidden underneath this layer of abstraction. You stop understanding what's actually going on, which leads to the vast majority of the security problems that we see. One just very simple example from some work I did is looking at this question of timing. So if you're analyzing a process that's doing some crypto or something else, and you want to compromise it and pull information out from it, timing is one of the channels by which information can leak from a trusted environment to an insecure environment. And there are all kinds of things that go on that affect timing. Today, it's essentially impossible to figure out how long a particular instruction will take on a complex modern CPU. when you figure all of these different things in here, unless you happen to have sort of the golden chip model from the company that made the specific model of CPU that you produced with the particular chipset that you produced, with the particular RAM chips that you're using, et cetera, you're going to have no way of figuring out what's going on. And when you add in things like bus contention, it becomes completely impossible. And so you have this problem then where we've now got these layers of abstraction underneath this assembler code that I showed you earlier, which make it really impossible for me to understand what that code is doing. And then we have layers of complexity above that where you have vast piles of this assembler code that are too great for a human to comprehend. And we're sort of stuck in the middle trying to secure this whole morass. I'm going to go very quickly here, but another example of work that we did my company a few years ago is we started looking at what the security implications were of transistor properties. So transistors are switches. When they switch, current flows. That means that the chip consumes more power, which means you see variations depending on what the chip is doing, and different instructions consume different amounts of power and have different profiles. And you can collect this information, and you can collect it for lots of different messages being processed if you're looking at the cryptographic properties of the device. Apply some interesting statistics, do some averaging, do some error correction, and if you know how to interpret what's going on, out pops the key. Again, so what we have here is a situation where something going on at the transistor level is compromising ultimately somebody's business objectives with a whole lot of different layers of abstraction in between. And everybody who designs transistors understands their power consumption profiles intimately. But once you go from the transistor to the logic unit, that information gets sort of watered down a bit. And then once you go from your XOR gate up to your sort of smaller groups of circuitry, up to your microprocessor, up to your assembly language, up to your protocol designer, to your cryptographic algorithms, to the person who's buying these chips at the end of the day, that information wasn't being passed from one person to the next. Each person was specializing in their particular layer of abstraction, and the critical information was getting lost. This particular issue, differential power analysis, still affects the vast majority of tamper-resistant chips being produced today. So if you want to keep a key in a circuit, there are lots and lots of ways that it can leak out. It's very hard to keep it in there. So what happens as complexity increases? So every 18 months, Moore's Law gives us this doubling in the number of transistors, which is a wonderful gift, but people take advantage of it and use it. So if we go from n lines of code to 2n lines of code, what does that mean? Well, the first thing it means is that we have, in the most naive accounting, twice as many opportunities for bugs. So if we're trying to build a system which is quote, secure in some binary notion of the word security, we have just squared the probability of success. So if we had a 20% chance of having zero bugs in n lines of code, we've fallen to a 4% chance of success with having 2 lines of code. Now, I'm being overly optimistic here, because if I go from having 4 elements to 8 elements, rather than just really doubling the number of opportunities for bugs, I'm actually essentially squaring the number of potential interactions in the system. And it turns out that interactions are a better measure of failure rates than straight lines of code. And so, for example, our odds of having no catastrophic weaknesses have now gone up to the 4th power. So our 20% chance of surviving when we had n lines of code has now fallen to much, much less than that. So this is really a major problem from the perspective of making defect-free systems. And I'll talk more about this a little bit later, but this is fundamentally why defect-free systems really don't exist anymore in the modern operating system and PC world. And one last little comment is I'm assuming here that flaw densities aren't increasing with complexity, but if you didn't double the size of your engineering team or increase it to match all this, you're probably going to have more defects rather than fewer per interaction. Now, there certainly are things that give you a one-time sort of constant factor improvement, like if you train your engineers and they produce half as many bugs per line of code, that gives you a one-time benefit. Or if you run source code analysis tools that can remove some percentage of your bugs, that gives you a constant factor improvement. But we're dealing with an exponentially increasing problem, and we're not gaining constant factors quickly enough and consistently enough to make up for that exponential growth in the problem. Well, so complexity is going to keep increasing. Can't stop Moore's Law. We shouldn't try. So if we're actually going to get better security over time, we have to do something different in terms of our architecture. Otherwise, we're just going to get buried in all the complexity. So I'm now going to start looking at some of the techniques that we're using. And I should probably begin this by saying that to some degree, there's nothing new in security. So some of the things that I'm going to talk about here are going to be adaptations of things that have been done before. I'll give credit in a few places, but I'm not going to claim that any of these ideas are brand new ones. These are recycling of ideas and perhaps applying them in slightly new ways. So if you take the problem, which in some ways is one of the conceptually simplest security problems, which is to take a key and an implementation of an algorithm and put it in a chip where it won't get leaked out by an adversary. Turns out that if you're using a full-blown CPU, this is incredibly difficult to do. Now, if you don't understand what the attacks are, it may seem simple, but the more you deal with this problem, the more horrifically complicated it gets, because there are just so many different things that your CPU could be doing that unless you understand absolutely all of them, you're going to miss something. And if you miss something, then the whole thing collapses. So we have to find a different approach to the traditional approach of throwing lots of code in there, lots of ROM, lots of RAM, and just hoping the whole thing stays secure. So every 18 months, we get twice as much functionality in our die area. And typically what happens, the way this gets used, is somebody starts out with a small chip, and then they add a whole bunch of additional things, like they make the caches bigger, they add more pipelining, they use up this gift that they get to make the CPU faster. So you start with a little microprocessor, which is relatively slow, you end up with a big microprocessor, which is much quicker. Rather than doing that, what I really think we should be considering, and what I'll talk about in a little more detail, is instead of making one big CPU, which is much more complicated, make a series of isolated units in the hardware, which actually let you use this additional power to isolate security components and keep individual simple components simple and dedicated to particular tasks. There will still be additional improvements that can be spent making the CPU bigger if you want, but to just use a little bit of this additional improvement on security. I'll talk about that in the next few slides here. One place where we've used this general philosophy in the field, as I was mentioning before, is tamper resistance. So you look at your typical smart card chip, and you've got inside there CPU, anything from 8051 sort of little micro up to 32-bit RISC CPUs, some I/O, some RAM, some ROM, some non-volatile memory, usually some cryptographic accelerators, all packed into one chip, which can then be packaged to the smart card or whatever other form factor you want. Turns out that these end up being large and complex and too big to really secure effectively. So by putting a little bit of extra circuitry in there, we can do some interesting things. And I'll talk about how this actually can be used in real-world systems in a couple of slides. So the concept at the highest level is we've got our die. We're going to throw some extra circuitry on there with its own private memory, its own logic, and a very well-defined security boundary, which is within the chip. So we've got this big, complicated chip, and we've got a chunk of logic, which is ours. We control it. We define what goes on inside of that boundary. And everything else outside of that is assumed to have relatively poor security or no security at all. So if you do this, it lets us do a couple of things that were impossible in the sort of traditional CPU model. First of all, we can get, because we have a really well-defined chip, intra-chip security boundary, we can get meaningful and testable security even if that complicated piece, the CPU and everything around it, is insecure, which is a really, really useful thing to do because if our choices are fix the CPU, which is really, really difficult, or our other alternative is to put something else in, it turns out putting something else in can be much easier. It means that the things that we want to do that are sort of nasty real-world problems like personalization and testing can be secured with hard crypto and can be managed at the boundary of this particular piece. Usually the way chips are tested is you put a scan chain in there where you or your adversary can shift data through essentially all the flip-flops in the chip. Yeah, you can try putting fuses on to try to block that, but regrowing fuses is one of the sort of basic techniques people with a FIB can do, so it doesn't really work very well. So you can build these required practical sorts of modes in with really strong cryptography around them. And you can manage your state really, really carefully. So, for example, when we build circuitry like this, we keep a budget and audit the number of flip-flops and make sure that every flip-flop in the final manufactured silicon is accounted for in the design, so there isn't any state that could surprise us later on. So the hardware state can be well-defined. You can actually build formal models of these circuits because they're so simple, whereas you can never really build a formal model of a modern CPU of the kinds of people are manufacturing today. And within this boundary, of course, we can put sort of usual complement of security features. Certainly, there's a point where somebody can break anything if they spend enough effort. But because you have now a simple component which is responsible for its own security, at least we're not going to have the complexity of the rest of the chip causing problems for what we're doing in our block. So this general concept here of adding special purpose security peripherals is one that can be applied beyond just sort of hard cryptographic tamper-resistant circuits. And it's one of the things that you can use these extra transistors for that actually gives a meaningful benefit. I'll talk a little bit about general application just to ordinary CPUs in just a minute here. In terms of the sort of really limited cryptographic applications like what I was showing on the previous slide, these techniques work really well in areas like pay TV where you have a decryption key that you need to protect so that somebody can't clone their satellite receiver and the account information associated with it. Or cell phones where you want to have a subsidy lock that prevents somebody from purchasing a $20 discounted prepaid cell phone and using it on another network and taking that subsidy and making money off of it. Or payment security and so forth. In terms of pay TV specifically, this general architecture is one that we've used in several systems and with tremendously good success. That's an area that I'll talk a little bit more about the threats later on, but all of the major systems previously have been hacked badly, and by putting dedicated hardware in to protect against the attacks, it's possible to make at least chips that are strong enough that the attackers go and they target something else. A little bit of the akin to the story of the guy putting on his tennis shoes when the lion is approaching. If you can strengthen your customer system to the point that the competitor gets hacked, you've been successful. In effect, the customer is twice as happy because their problem goes away and the customer costs double. So you get a double competitive advantage there. In terms of the architecture that gets used here, in your traditional conditional access module used in a system like DVB, Digital Video Broadcasting Standard, which is what most of the satellite systems use today or variants of it, you have a couple of different kinds of messages that come over the air, some that are sort of general broadcast messages that can be picked up by all devices or targeted to specific devices, and then channel-specific information used for computing the decryption keys for a particular channel. The traditional model for one of these things is you've got a bunch of software and a CPU that basically computes a key, which gets called a control word, I think, because of export controls. Nobody wanted to call them keys when the standard was being designed. The control word gets spit out and used in a standard decryption algorithm. But by adding extra hardware into the process that also contributes to those decryption keys, somebody has to break both this component and this component in order to be able to compute the actual control word that's going to be generated. So if your attack is somebody trying to take a legitimate subscribed account and clone it, they've got twice as much work to do. So by adding some extra complexity into the system, by adding this extra component, we've actually forced the adversary to break two things instead of one. And there's no reason we couldn't put 50 of these into a chip. It's just a question of diarrhea and cost. And by adding 50 different components, XORing their contributions all together, we've now made a chip 50 times larger, but we forced the attacker to break 50 different components all at once to make a successful attack, rather than giving the attacker one component which is 50 times larger that they need to break. So if the probability of somebody breaking each component originally was, say, 50-50, the probability of somebody breaking 50 independent components would be dramatically less. Now, you can't necessarily assume that your security is independent because you may have common failure modes, but it's still clearly much better than having one giant fattened beast that somebody can go after. Right, so the question is, what stops somebody from stealing the video out and replicating it? There are two answers to that question. One is nothing. If you look at most TV programming, the freshness of the programming is what people want. So yesterday's news is not really worth much. Now, somebody could redistribute it in real time, and then in those kinds of situations, they're basically the process that you have to go through is one of forensic analysis and shutting down the source of that leak. One real-world example is there was a mafioso compound in Italy where somebody was rebroadcasting, actually not the video, but the keys to decrypt the video in real time and selling it in the town. No police officer was willing to go in there and shut this down, so it ran for quite a few years. Ultimately, what you need to do, though, is figure out, okay, which is the subscribed account that these are coming from, which means that you have to make the pattern of keys identify the particular subscriber and subscribed account that's used, do some analysis by recovering pirated information, figure out which subscriber it's tied to, and shut off that particular account. It's messy and it's slow. Currently, the piracy has, essentially the vast majority of it, concentrated on breaking the actual tamper resistance of the devices. But as you harden one component of the system, you'll force the adversaries clearly to attack. So they're less attractive from the adversary point of view, but still provide some attacker benefit. So this approach has some nice benefits. It's really, really cheap in volume. You've got a pretty big NRE building custom hardware, but the incremental cost of the gates is low and it's falling. So by putting a little extra hardware in there, that actually can be much cheaper, for example, than trying to address all of the just software bugs in the code running in the CPU. Going through and testing 64 kilobytes of code written in assembler is nobody's idea of a good time. But putting a little bit of extra hardware in can actually be cheaper than doing that engineering. And because we're focused exclusively on solving a very narrow problem and have dedicated hardware to do it, and we can do things like manage our state machines that will only go through very, very well-defined sequences of operations, it's extremely testable, and you can get a much higher level of assurance than you can get with any other kind of approach. So this has been rolled out. There are millions of these things, chips with this deployed, and they've worked so far. Now, clearly, nobody can say that any security system is unbreakable, but when you're dealing with a problem like pay TV piracy, the question is, what are the losses incurred by the system operator? And if you're not observing any problems, then you're solving the business need. So this same general approach can be taken to CPUs and other kinds of systems. So the concept here is to simply take your extra transistors and use them to build isolated execution areas rather than a bigger CPU. So you can think of this a little bit as sort of akin to the cell methodology that's used in some of the IBM chips, like the ones used in the PlayStation 3, where you have independent computation areas that can then talk through sort of general, perhaps even somewhat slow protocols with the main CPU in the system. So here we would put completely independent hardware in for doing specific tasks. So we have separate processing capabilities, separate RAM, separate key management. So fully independent operation is really important. Otherwise, you're going to have issues like timing interdependencies that are really, really difficult to manage. And these little units can then communicate with the main CPU. So the main CPU would still be responsible for performing tasks like if you want to do paging securely, and you would encrypt your data and page it out to disk and let the main CPU handle a task like that.
Isn't that what a DPM is, basically?
Well, let me choose my words carefully here. A TPM is in some ways yes, but in other ways no. So you have a little bit of cryptographic support in the TPM, but it sits on a bus that talks to a giant CPU. The TPM by itself can't really solve any problems for you. Instead, it provides a service to the rest of the CPU, and then you have the sort of the different sort of privilege modes within the main CPU that try to take advantage of this to build some kind of an overall security assertion. But if you sort of think of your CPU as an octopus, the TPM sort of strategy is like trying to graft an exoskeleton onto the octopus, as opposed to trying to put separate little components on that solve specific problems. So there certainly is some similarity there, but what I'm proposing here is a little bit different. I'll describe how this would work in some application areas and perhaps contrast a bit with the sort of TPM-based approaches. So one just simple example is that it's absolutely crazy to make the main CPU on your laptop be responsible for network security. It's running all kinds of software. Nobody has any clue what the drivers on their PCs actually are all doing. It's just this hugely complex beast, And to have it directly exposed to malicious traffic coming in from the outside is just a horrific security problem. There have been some great papers recently looking at, for example, the exploits against Wi-Fi drivers, but that's just one of many examples of why it's a bad idea to put the main CPU directly exposed to anything coming in from the outside. So if I want to secure this, one obvious thing to do is to lug a physical firewall around with me or a VPN box. That helps a little bit. Everybody knows the problems with firewalls, but can do something a little bit better than what I can do with the main CPU, because at least it puts an extra step that can, if I'm lucky, at least block incoming connections. So why not just put a separate processing engine for specifically firewall and VPN functionality into the microprocessor? So there's no reason that should be a separate box that I'm carrying around. It should be a few extra gates on my main CPU, which operate independently from the rest of the chip. So by doing this, I can put some processing engine which sits between the main CPU and the network ports. The CPU can't, any of its communication through the network would need to go through this extra processing area so that, for example, if I want to make a VPN that will only allow my laptop to send encrypted packets that are usable by my home network and only receive encrypted data from my home network so I've got a secure tunnel, that can be handled completely within this. And even if the CPU is compromised, there's not going to be an attack vector where the main CPU can get unencrypted, can get exposed to raw data coming in out from outside of this VPN connection. So if we look forward 10 years, Moore's Law will give us, 15 years, we'll have 1,000 times as much computing hardware. So we can have, even if we want multiple independent computing engines for network security, so if we want to have a couple of different firewalls, 5 or 6 different VPNs all being used in serial, we can do that. And the cost of doing it is effectively negligible because we're going to have the transistors. They're already just about free today, and they're going to become even freer if such a thing is possible over time. So if you wanted to do this, you could have as many steps independently along the way, each responsible for enforcing the critical security policies. And as you add more of these, so long as you build the system properly, you should be able to get improvements in security by adding this extra complexity as opposed to reductions in security. There are other examples of problems where dedicated hardware also can do a really effective job. So if you're interested in managing keys, you shouldn't store those on the hard drive. Having some extra logic with its own private non-volatile memory is the right way to do that. If you want to do secure input, you can have a little CPU that handles input from the keyboard and the mouse. Again, the cost of this is virtually negligible. And already today, your keyboards and mice have CPUs in them. It's just a question of putting extra CPU power onto the main CPU or other parts of the chipset. If you want a secure display, again, separate processing engines can handle this. Secure storage, having an extra CPU handling what's going in and out of the disk. And by keeping all of these independent from each other and allowing perhaps multiple of these to coexist, makes it possible for somebody who's building these security systems to write their security code without having to worry nearly as much about the unintended interactions where the Wi-Fi driver can clobber the sound card driver or vice versa. They're operating completely separately from each other. When I've talked about this with people, one of the questions that often comes up is, so you could do this, but you're just going to clobber performance, aren't you? And I would make the claim that actually CPU performance is already becoming essentially irrelevant. There are very, very few applications where people really care about the speed of their CPUs today, and the number of those applications is going to decrease over time. And in the vast majority of cases, what people would really rather have is a PC that ran at half the speed but was extremely reliable, as opposed to a computer that runs as fast as you can possibly make it but has all kinds of security vulnerabilities. The techniques that I'm talking about here, I'm looking at from a hardware-centric viewpoint. The same concepts also exist in the software world. Sandboxing and isolation and breaking down systems and decompositing into the components properly. There's been a huge amount of research there. A really great paper, it's one by Peter Neumann and others at SRI. The title of the paper is essentially unpronounceable, but the paper is extremely readable. So please forgive the title, but the paper is certainly a good read. So I'm going to move on to another part of the talk here, unless somebody wants to. I'm running a little ahead of time, so if anybody wants to jump in with any questions, ideas, thoughts, criticisms, vegetables, anything, go for it.
Yeah, So what do you do when things break? When you have things in hardware, you can't really upgrade.
That's actually a very good question. And when you work with hardware designers, everybody talks about how crappy a job software designers do. Hardware designers do a much better job. They actually already understand security in some ways, because when you make your ASIC, it better not break, because it's going to cost you a lot of money. With independent processing engines that run code that can be signed and loaded into them, with an auditing mechanism to make sure that the components can see each other but not compromise each other, you can allow a certain degree of customization in the field. But to a large degree, it comes down to making sure that you designed it right from the beginning. And that's what hardware forces you to do, because it's baked into logic.
Okay, so why not engineer your software to have the same separation you were already doing in your hardware? Whether it's virtual machine separation, or whether it's having some compiler that proves that there's, you know, limited interactions between this module and that module. You know, why not leverage Moore's Law to analyze your code?
Well, the problem of making code analysis tools means that you have to make a program that understands whether a program has problems. And I'm going to talk about that particular problem in just a few minutes here. Certainly, I'm a big fan of microkernel-based operating systems, where you have a very, very limited OS that has pieces that plug into it that are isolated. And that kind of architecture can work pretty well. But we've already got this beast here, which is the x86 architecture. And we can't just say, this is a bad architecture, let's throw it out and start from scratch and expect to actually be able to get anybody to buy those new systems. So given where we are today, we have to evolve into a situation where we have better security. And adding components is something that we can do from an evolutionary perspective, whereas junking Windows or Linux really isn't a realistic alternative. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Yeah.
You've sort of answered my question. The extension that it would seem that for devices, network devices, that sort of thing, a general purpose operating system isn't the best solution. You know, going with just a machine language microkernel?
Anything you can do that isolates the components, the better. I mean, Ring Zero was a really regrettable decision that somebody made to run all code at the lowest privilege level when the PC and sort of first versions of Windows were being put together. In terms of the security blunders discussed earlier, I would have put Ring Zero in the Ford Pinto gas tank as probably two of mine.
Quick question. So the thing that I've noticed a lot in real-world situations is that you don't know what to firewall. You don't actually necessarily know what pieces of data that are coming in are the ones that are harmful. You know, it's difficult to predict precisely what's going to hurt the user's browser, et cetera. So I can have a piece of hardware here that's sitting between, you know, that's sitting between the operating system and the main processor and the network. But if I don't actually know what it is that I want to filter, that I want to prevent from getting into the main operating system, et cetera, then how, you know, then merely the fact that I have this hardware doesn't help me. And if I know what it is that I need to block, you know, I can implement that in, you know, in various kinds of filtering in the OS itself relatively straightforwardly.
Well, so to take the case of a browser then. So there are a couple different places where you can try to add browser type security. One, for example, is you could take the whole browser application and shove it into a separate CPU, which with a perhaps additional CPU managing the persistent information, such as cookies if you want to support that, and say, okay, it's perfectly fine for this browser instance to get clobbered by the website that it's visiting, but as soon as you go to another web page, we're going to shut that particular CPU down, clean it out, bring up another one. Now, again, horribly inefficient, but we've got the CPU horsepower to be able to do that, coming because of Moore's Law.
But of course, you can do that in software too, relatively straightforwardly. You could design a browser such that, you know, that there was no persistent data, and that every time you went to another site, it brought up a new instance of the process image.
Right, but supposing I'm going to evil.com and download a little bit of Java code because I want to see the animations and things there. How do I know that Java code isn't exploiting timing information leaking from my hard disk encryption software, which is responsible for protecting data being stored onto my hard disk, or the keys being used in my VPN application.
But that presumably means, though, that browser application somehow is getting information about, you know, about things that are going on the disk. And so if it needs to get information on stuff, I still don't quite understand how it is that, you've thought about this more than I have, so presumably you have some ideas, but I'm not quite getting them from your presentation, I suppose.
Okay, so there certainly is a convergence between where you draw your boundaries between hardware and software. And you can do things in anything you can do in hardware, you can, to a certain degree, do in software. Anything you can do in software, at least in theory, you can do in hardware. So to try to draw a firm line and say, these are things that you should do in software and these are things you should do in hardware, you will always be able to say, okay, there's this fuzzy boundary where you could make a decision about pushing it one direction or the other. Dealing with covert channels is a horrifically complicated problem. So when you're trying to have malicious code and good code running in the same hardware, that's very, very difficult to do. So if you want to be able to have malicious code and good code together, separate hardware makes that possible, whereas shared memory chips, shared operating systems, shared RAM caches, all of these sorts of things make that very, very dangerous. So that's the sort of crux of the differentiation between why you'd want hardware over software. Let me do a couple more comments, and then I'll move on to the next part of my talk. There'll be some more time afterwards.
Hi. Maybe it's a little bit an oversimplified picture, but let's say you have regular computers of today. This is a database server. This is a file server. This is a VPN machine. This is a firewall. They're all connected on the network. Now you increase computer power dramatically, and you push everything into a single box, but this is one CPU, another CPU, the third, the fourth. Well, if you think about what we have now, if you have multiple computers on the network, it doesn't really increase security and reliability very much, and you have a significant maintenance and other types of overhead making it all working together. Plus, if it's on the hardware, then the bug fix, and we just had a presentation before, I mean, the original vulnerability numbers, then subsequent, subsequent revisions. Still, most of those vulnerabilities are in the initial code. Now you have a hardware piece, okay, which is not as difficult to easy to patch as software. You have multiple computers that you brought together. You do have your CPU and all the power, but I mean, at least to me, not an academician, it doesn't really look very convincing that logically you're going to achieve like a better result.
Well, so if you go to a corporate data center today, there are racks of computers, and everybody's afraid of putting, nobody would put their firewall running on the same box as their critical application server, because you want to have these in separate hardware. And so for the places today where you have separate hardware in individual boxes, certainly there's no reason you can't get the same benefits by pushing it all into a single chip. Now, the question of whether you would want to break, whether this solves all, certainly this does not solve all problems. I am not in the least proposing that this makes security difficulties vanish, but it does give you a way to, for example, make a laptop which can have the benefits of VPN hardware, separate key management hardware, and all of these different components that today are separate and are not integrated together into one system.
That I agree. I'm not sure. I see that the number of vulnerabilities is going to decrease by putting everything into one single element. That's my question.
And you may not even decrease the number of vulnerabilities, but you may just make it so that the pieces that fail don't bring down other pieces. And that by itself can be a useful property. Yes?
Any comments on software reengineering, especially with respect to stack, where most of the software developers either borrow stacks or they're under timeline constraints. They actually take software that may have not fully tested and or may have the functions and features that unfortunately does have the security holes.
That's actually the next part of my talk. So okay. let me use that as the introduction to it and say, okay, so when we look at today's PCs running today's operating systems where we don't have extra hardware, and we have this vast complexity being built, software developers churning up vast quantities of code. Let's look at it from that perspective. So this is a, let's take sort of a fairly typical kind of problem. When you go to a website, there's some business reasons why it's nice to be able to have users have confidence that their credit card information is being protected. And so Microsoft and Netscape and the browser vendors came up with the beautiful security lock icon, which means that you're running the SSL protocol, which is to some part my fault, which means that you have various certificates that you're trusting. So you can go and see, okay, what search are you trusting? This is sort of the default stuff in IE. I have no idea who a bunch of these companies are. VeriSign is better than most in that they have at least a practice statement describing what their certs mean and what they don't mean and all the different ways that they're not liable if anything goes wrong. But at least they document it. This is not a criticism of VeriSign versus anybody else. It's just a criticism of everybody. And this thing runs a couple hundred pages, 105 pages, I forget exactly. There's all the different configuration options that I'm sure everybody here sets intelligently. And at the end of the day, that's connecting to a web server, which has probably got all kinds of other vulnerabilities in it as well. And yet the lock icon serves in a really important task for end users in that they won't type their credit cards in without it. So this is a pretty typical sort of problem. If we want to just secure this entire morass, there's just no way to take the kind of approach that I was describing before, where we're really going to sit down and lock everything down, have confidence that it's built correctly. We just have way too many layers of crud piled on top of each other, and they're all just horrifically complicated. Nobody understands really any component fully by itself, with perhaps the exception of the icon picture to begin with, and the interactions between them are just far beyond human comprehension. And essentially all of the layers, with few exceptions, are riddled with bugs. So if you take your typical web server, there are undoubtedly numerous bugs in there. You look at the hardware and software being used by the CA who's managing the root keys, there are issues there, the browser issues there. Just it's all an unsolvable nightmare, and it's getting scarier. But there's far too much at stake to be able to just abandon ship. So that's not an option. And when you think about it, there's really just one reason why this even works today. There's just a single security tool which is making the entire internet work. It's why my PC is something I can take to my hotel room, connect out, make it do useful things, and it's called patches. If it wasn't for patches, everything would grind to a complete and total and disastrous halt. So we are living in a world where security failure is expected, but to be honest, I mean, in the previous panel discussion, was focusing on sort of what the worst security disasters were in the last 30 years. And in none of the examples did anybody die. I don't think there were any fatality. Were there some in the... Okay. A few fatalities here and there. But the impact of the problem is actually a lot less than what really anybody would predict. And the reason for it is that these systems keep getting upgraded. As problems arise, they get dealt with.
Excuse me, what about Chernobyl?
Is it fair to call Chernobyl a computer security failure? I'm not familiar enough. Actually not familiar enough with what actually happened there.
We're experimenting with the safety controls. We didn't do it very well.
Okay. Does that mean that one should never experiment with security systems? Won't make any Digital Millennium Copyright Act comments because. So, if you look at Microsoft today, to pick them as actually the best of many bad examples, they have given up on building systems which have effective defenses in them. There's nobody at Microsoft who is sane will tell you that there are zero bugs in any of their products. It's just a question of how quickly they can fix them versus how quickly people will exploit them, and whether the zero-day exploits are coming at a rate that makes the product usable for most users or unusable for most users. So the security problem that we're dealing with is not one where we're going to win. At best, we can sort of keep this stalemate going, where each time there's a problem, we try to minimize the pain that it causes to the end users. We try to make it so that rather than having a system collapse in some horrific failure mode, instead it's just a question of where a small number of users, or hopefully a small number, are affected. We do an update, and life goes on. Occasionally something like Code Red comes along, and it costs quite a bit of money. But even the worst viruses cost a lot less than people's money than people actually spend on computer security. So to try to argue that the damage is completely unmanageable is a little bit of a hard case to make. There are a bunch of problems that fall into this category of stalemate problems, and essentially all of the major interesting computer security problems today to some degree fall in this category. So spam is an example that I'll talk about in a little bit of more detail in a couple of slides here, but payment fraud, for example, there's a stalemate between methods for blocking illegitimate transactions and methods for doing fraud. Each time there's a new fraud technique that comes along, there will be new scoring techniques to try to deal with it. And at the end of the day, these systems are immensely profitable. Citibank's market cap is over $200 billion. The fraud of the credit card industry as a whole is a few billion dollars a year. Clearly, something is working pretty well, even though this problem is a completely unsolvable one. Viruses, PCs, network security, I'll talk about a couple of these in future slides going forward. But these are all stalemates where fundamentally the defensive mechanisms are insecure. There are holes in them, there are weaknesses in them. It's just a question of whether they get exploited catastrophically before they can be patched. And so long as that doesn't happen, these systems keep limping on. So if we think of spam as a sort of typical example of a stalemate problem. So if I have a spam message here, I'm not sure why I need weight loss, but this was one of the ones that showed up in my inbox. Better not lose 30 pounds. So given this spam, it's pretty easy to make a filter that will detect that. And then the spammers learn from the filters, and they can then make spam messages that evade it. So, for example, putting in some text that looks legitimate with a picture that then causes you to do something that you shouldn't. Click on that, it takes you somewhere. The spammer then has got a way to beat the filter that's looking for particular messages here. You can then make a new filter that looks for images and looks at what's in those. And we have this battle between the spam detectors and the spam authors, and we're really in a stalemate. For most users who are diligent about keeping their spam filtering going, it works pretty well. Although if you don't keep paying your renewal fee for your spam filtering service, then at that point you end up getting clobbered, which is actually great from the perspective of the company making the anti-spam tool, but not so great if you're a user. So we have this cycle here. So given a new spam message, I can make a new detector, which will then detect that message or class of messages. The spammer learns what the detector is doing, and we go endlessly around this cycle. Now, given the alternatives, this stalemate is actually a really great outcome. It's far better than losing. So if you look at this from the perspective of the adversary's goal is to just win the game, defeat all the spam filters permanently and completely, and not have to deal with updating their systems anymore to produce new methods of spamming. So their goal is to prevent this renewal process from being effective. Likewise, from a defender's perspective, if I can win the game and come up with a spam filter that will work no matter what the spammer does, then I can win. But so long as I'm willing to receive arbitrary messages from arbitrary users, I don't have any sort of external protocol for authenticating where the messages are coming from, I'm not going to be able to do that. So my best hope is to be able to keep this cycle going forever. So if you want a stalemate, your opponent doesn't. So each side in this battle is trying to end the stalemate and win, but neither is able to do it. And I'll talk about this in just a moment. There are some examples of cases where clearly the stalemates have failed. So the protection on the DVD copy protection system is actually a pretty good example. The encryption that was used there included a revocation mechanism. There were many design problems that I won't go into the details of, but the cipher that they used was bad, and there were some other issues that made it so once a catastrophic attack would occur that made it so that there was no ability to do a response to the attacks that actually arose. But it was designed with this in mind, and just that it didn't work out that way. Likewise, you find systems that will, or attacks that try to block the response. So the blasters attempt to DOS the Windows Update facility is an example of an attempt to do that. It almost worked, but didn't. But if it had worked, it would have been really quite interesting. If you can't detect the attacks, it doesn't work. And there are also some catastrophic kinds of attack where being able to, for example, fix the software at Chernobyl, if it was a software problem, really wouldn't be of much use. And I'll talk about all of these in just a little bit. So if we look at our operating system security today, we have malware and attacks and Trojans, we have security code, and we're going through this cycle. And one of the things that thinking about this reminded me of is what we're really doing is we've gone back about 20 years and we're playing Core Wars all over again, but we're doing it in people's PCs. The one difference, though, is that with the original Core Wars, the rules were defined at the beginning. But the battleground here is growing with exponential increase in complexity, which creates some really interesting properties that I'll talk about in just a minute. When you talk about the operating system sort of stalemate, one of the questions that people often ask about is virtualization, whether that could essentially allow the attacker to win or allow the defender to win. So if you can, if you're the adversary, for example, and you can virtualize the operating system and run it in the matrix so that it can't detect that it's running in this malicious environment, and there's no way to make a detector that can differentiate between the bad environment and the good environment, you can win as an attacker because, for example, your antivirus program will have no way of knowing that there's a virus sitting outside of it and hidden from its operation. Now, the defense wins, or can at least continue the stalemate here, if there's any imperfection in the virtualization. So if, for example, the RAM cache timing behavior is a little different because there's some extra device drivers and extra code running in this external layer, then I can detect this, then I can go ahead and make a countermeasure to the attack. So the question ultimately comes down to whether there is any little quirk or behavior or minutia that differentiates the virtualized environment from the legitimate uncompromised environment. And from an attacker perspective, this is really difficult because to make a perfect virtualized environment means I have to understand the whole environment. So it has to be not just bug-free. This isn't like making a functional piece of software that can do virtualization. I'm talking about trying to make it completely indistinguishable from a legitimate system, which then depends on the complexity of the environment that I'm trying to emulate, and that itself is growing exponentially, which leads to the interesting question that perhaps this exponential growth in the complexity of our systems will be essential for being able to keep them secure, in that it will make it impossible for the adversaries to virtualize legitimate components of the system. I'm now going to look at just a couple, very quickly go through a few actual sort of real-world systems where the reactive strategy has been used with different degrees of success. So pay TV piracy is a topic I talked about a little bit earlier in terms of the hardware that we've been building in that environment. But even if you go back to the systems built shortly after the video cipher debacle in the 80s, what the system operators quickly learned is that they couldn't rely on security systems to not fail. So they built systems where you could update the security components, you could remove a smart card or some other piece of hardware that would let you replace the key cryptographic elements that hopefully the adversaries will focus their attacks on. And so you end up with this process where sort of a software bug exploit. So here's a post, for example, where attackers are talking about a buffer overflow in one of the security modules that's used in pay TV systems. Or they'll use glitching or power analysis or emulation or hardware modification. There are all these kinds of sort of practical things that attackers do to be able to break these systems. And there's a reason why attackers are doing this, which you need to understand to get your sort of mind around this problem. And a lot of it has to do with Canada. In Canada, you cannot legally purchase American pay TV programming because it doesn't contain the appropriate French content and whatnot. Somebody who's Canadian here might know a little bit more about the regulatory reasons for this. But Canadians also want to see American TV programming. I'm not exactly sure why either, but the average American spends somewhere around $60 a month for satellite TV. Cable's about the same. DirecTV is a little higher than that. EchoStar is a little lower than that. So you've got somewhere around $600-$700 per year per person who's legitimately subscribing to these services. And if you're in Canada and you can't get it legitimately, you pay a premium over what the Americans are paying. So there are somewhere around 1 million, 2 million people in Canada who are getting American TV signals without being properly subscribed to them because they want to get this and they're paying more than the Americans will for the same service. So the amount of money sloshing around in this system is absolutely staggering. You've got hundreds of millions of dollars being spent by just the Canadians to try to get access to the American signals, which would be fine if that was all that happened. But it turns out that once there's been an attack that services the Canadian market, it spills over into the U.S. market. It starts cannibalizing legitimate sales. If you go to Walmart and you buy a satellite TV receiver, that box is heavily subsidized. You'll be paying $50 to $100 for something that costs several hundred dollars to make. That box subsidy is clearly lost if you become a pirate. It also means that you're unlikely to subscribe to legitimate programming. The National Cable Telecommunications Association estimate is there's about $5 billion of additional revenue that the system operators would get if there wasn't piracy, and that's assuming that the pirates became average subscribers. So you could argue about whether those numbers are about right, but that's just the U.S. and just the cable market. And you have the same dynamic elsewhere. So you have this extreme pressure on the technical systems. In fact, of the different systems that I've worked on, printer cartridges and pay TV systems have the greatest pressure in the commercial world that we've run into in terms of attackers making large amounts of money and really being very, very focused and dedicated on finding creative ways to compromise the security. Got big money, big, lots of organized crime. When the guys get busted doing this, they're usually doing a dozen different kinds of fraud. You know, they'll have check forging equipment, they'll be doing credit card fraud, they'll be forging identity documents and a little pay TV on the side. So there's all this kinds of stuff that you could buy but don't. So in order to survive in this world, what pay TV operators do is they make it so that the hardware can be updated in order to renew the security and prolong the stalemate. So if one hardware module gets broken, a fresh one can be rolled out. And the new security modules, at least the system operator hopes, will reset the stalemate. So you'll have some goals of making a new hardware module that fixes the problems in the last one, make it so that ideally the cost of breaking will be prohibitive, so that the competitors will get hacked instead of you, and have countermeasures built in to the broadest possible range of attacks. So these systems work pretty well. The fact that the system operators have been through this cycle several times means that they really understand the process well. And the primary objective now is on building these chips strong enough that they can actually last in the field for a significant period of time. Most chips get broken before the old generation of chips gets fully shut off, so you don't get the benefit that you wanted. Another example where stalemates have worked beautifully, actually, is with piracy of Academy screeners. So in Hollywood, if you make a movie and you want to win awards, the people who vote on the award have to be able to see the movie. So you need to ship copies of the movie out to these people because they're too lazy to go to the theater to see your movie. So you need to ship them a VHS tape or a DVD. And for a long time, essentially every movie that was being released as a screener was getting massively pirated. And there was no practical way to ship the movies to these people in a form where they couldn't be copied. So the solution was to add one piece that was missing, which is necessary for a stalemate to work, which is a back channel of information telling you after something has gone wrong. So the technology that was used is to put forensic marks into the screener copies that were sent out. Very low-tech stuff for the most part. Conceptually, it could be as simple as just, you know, changing a few pixels in one particular frame of a movie. In practice, what gets done is a little bit more obtrusive than that. But putting unique information in each copy. So adding this back channel created a stalemate, whereas before the studios were essentially losing the game every single time they tried playing. Today, when a movie gets pirated, the sources of it get immediately traced and shut off. There was a B-list actor, Carmen Caridi, who was feeding his movies to a guy named Russell Sprague, and Carmen got kicked out of the Academy, and Russell's in jail today. And they were kind of the test case. And today, it's actually being really successful because the piracy has become self-limiting. Another example of a system, an approach built around this, was used in a merchant credit card database where the merchant realized that it was really expensive and cumbersome to run high security servers for their customer lists. So they decided that they would instead just audit everything. And what happened is the attackers broke in, took all the information, and that merchant had to mail out mailings to all of their customers in California because of the compromise. So didn't work here at all. So there are places where this works and places where it doesn't work. One perhaps slightly controversial example that I'll talk about is some work that my company is doing for optical disc formats. So if you look at your sort of DVD-type formats today, they have content which is data. It's MPEG encrypted audio and video sitting on a physical disc, which is manipulated by a player that includes a bunch of security logic in it. Now, this is not a particularly good design because if something goes wrong, really all you can do is shut off the players and their cryptographic keys that are affected. But the disc itself has no role in its own security. It's just dumb data that's being acted on by something outside of it. The alternative architecture that we've been building involves moving the software out of the player where it really doesn't belong, putting it in some code on the disk that can run in a virtual environment with some special ways of exploring its environment, figuring out what kind of environment it's running in. And so long as this code has both appropriate sandboxing on it so it can't harm the environment, but also the ability to observe and detect what has been done to its environment, you can get a renewal capability where if something starts going horribly wrong, rather than shutting off players and affecting them, you can put software on your new titles that can do something better. Your old titles are still affected, but Hollywood makes the vast majority of its money right after a new release. It's a hit business where in a window of just a couple of months, you get the vast majority of your revenue. One other neat thing about this kind of approach is to get that sort of risk management cycle I was talking about earlier, you need to have, first of all, the control to do something after something is going wrong, but you also have to know what happened. So if you don't have the ability to get feedback about what your compromises are, like when the studios were unable to learn about which Academy members were the sources of the piracy of the screeners, there was no way they could build this sort of a cycle. When you have security code running in a player, one of the things it can do is it can put information into the ordinary output being displayed to the user, which identifies attributes of the device that's playing it. So if you have a malicious piece of software running on that device, and it can put fingerprints of that software into the actual content being rendered, it means that when you recover a pirated copy, you get some information, but somebody who's not participating in piracy's privacy is assured. I talked earlier about operating system security and sort of the Core Wars type of a model that we've fallen into. So when we look at this topic, in the security world, it's sort of considered immoral to ship products that are breakable. When you listen to people making comments here, for example, often they sort of say, well, we should get people to write better software. We should get usually somebody else to do something better so that this problem would go away. But when you look at the real world, this is what we have. So the practical aspect of it is that it's actually much cheaper to respond to problems because you know what you need to respond to. Whereas if you're trying to build a defense, you don't know where somebody's going to attack you from, so you end up putting resources around this huge perimeter, and typically you're going to miss some spots, you're still going to have attacks, and you end up coming back to having to respond anyway. It gives you a very quick time to market, although you have some ongoing engineering that results from doing that. The liability of doing a stalemate type approach appears that it may actually be less than trying to make systems that rely on defenses, because you can issue a response and then blame the users who don't patch, as opposed to trying to make something and claiming it's perfect and then being imperfect in that defense. And it's much, much easier than doing good security testing. So from a sort of moral perspective, it involves shipping fundamentally insecure systems. So if you're advertising, and the companies that advertise these systems as secure are certainly walking in a fine line. And they're certainly ineffective in a lot of cases. Like if you take the example of World War II cryptanalysis, I talked about the Enigma machine at the beginning of this talk. The Germans never really found out that it was being broken. They didn't know that the Poles, then the French, then the Brits, and then the Americans were breaking their codes. And because they weren't fully aware of the degree of cryptanalysis going on, they never were able to upgrade the code in a way that made it unbreakable. And they're also bad in the notion that there is no basis for trusting their security. In fact, they are not secure if you ask whether these systems meet any kind of binary notion of security. But it's a lot better than the alternatives, which is to have systems like the internet come to a screeching halt. So I'll wrap up here by looking sort of back at this question of these cycles, where we look at these stalemate problems where you have detectors or countermeasures that are being rolled out. So in this kind of a model here, we've got a person who's making a detector or a defense component. We have a person who's making the attacks, and they're producing software at each point here. So it starts to get kind of interesting when you begin automating these processes. So if you look at the spam world, for example, there are various techniques like Bayesian filters for making filters that get automatically updated to reflect the problem as it evolves. And there are also automated attack tools, like spammers have built systems using thesauruses and checking messages against the popular filters. And so you end up then with tasks that were originally being done by people being automated here. And so this question comes up, okay, so how does this end? We've gone from having the people mounting the attacks to people making the tools that detect and create the attacks. And there isn't any clear answer to where it ends. It's probably all an undecidable mess, where undecidable is sort of in the computer science notion, where, for example, having a program be able to analyze and understand another program is believed to be impossible. Although there's some caveats here in the real world, malware has to work within bounded time and bounded memory, which makes the proofs fall apart a little bit. There are some problems then where the last mover advantage will sort of always remain. So the last mover advantage notion here is that whoever makes the latest step, the latest spam message or the latest detector, wins until the other party responds. And so we then sort of build this model where we have program analyzers that are analyzing the attacks, we have attack generators that are analyzing these. So if the defender in this world actually did win, it would be extremely sort of unsatisfying in that it would mean, for example, that the AES is a public key crypto system because obfuscation is possible. If the attacker wins, that also has really weird implications because it means that programs can understand arbitrary programs, and that isn't supposed to be possible, as I talked about a second ago. And so we end up with sort of this situation where we keep putting humans in to sort out the mess. And so the humans are writing the software to circumvent the defenses. We're writing the software to make the defenses. And so all of this is assuming that we are smarter than our computers are. So if the attack software is more intelligent than the humans, then the attacker wins. Likewise, the defense software can become more intelligent than humans. The defender wins. And this is not satisfactory because it means that our software cannot therefore contain any kind of artificial intelligence, and we're saying that artificial intelligence is hopeless. But the only consolation that I've been able to come up with is that if the software does get to be smarter than we are, we're obsolete. In which case, until that point occurs, we have lots of interesting problems to work on, and computer security is going to remain a game where human intelligence is really the only thing that we have to work with to deal with this kind of complexity, which goes very back to the beginning slide where I pointed out that we have exponential growth in complexity and we're not getting smarter. And so I don't have a solution to that particular problem. So I've got a few more minutes for discussion. So anybody who has any...
I was hoping you would answer the question before.
Well, ask it again. And
yeah, I said I liked your more logic, I would say, and how the progress from taking number of transistors into the millions, as in Intel's, and how code has went from N to 2N. So my basic question was, with respect to software re-engineering, where most companies today, mainly startups, take a code that already exists, either on the web or buy it from somebody, specifically stacks, reuse it in their product, and that same stack happened to be either vulnerable or has a certain bug that has been replicated now across multiple companies that have been absorbed by other companies, and therefore it's not really introducing new security flaws, but it's the same problem starting all over with a new release and or with a new product that is coming out. My question is, it would be nice to see how your Moore's Law apply to a concept like this, and how would you suggest that you will address or a company would address this kind of situation? Thank you.
So, I mean, code reuse creates a lot of problems, and the question of what to do when a component fails isn't one that's really well addressed by any model that I can point to. What I'm thinking of right now is when MD5 failed and people were finding practical cryptanalytic attacks against it, many of the companies that we work with had this horrifyingly difficult problem of figuring out where the MD5 was used in their products. And the best approach ended up being typically to just scan the binaries for the magic constants that are part of the MD5 algorithm, which would work with almost no other type of a security failure, but it just happened to work right there. To some degree, the solution to that problem involves isolating components so that they can't compromise the rest of the system. For example, my word processor should not have any ability to access anything other than the files that I have told it to open and told it to save to. Likewise, my web browser should not be able to write anything to my hard drive besides the perhaps cookies and a few very well-defined pieces of information that are localized to that particular application. So by cutting off the interconnections between applications, we can make the systems much more tolerant of bugs in individual components. But the fundamental issue of the trade-off between having layers of abstraction there to give you the engineering benefits of them, but not having any of the security issues being concealed by it, you can't have your cake and eat it too. When we do hardware design in my company, we intentionally avoid a lot of the really hard to understand abstracting layers that are commonly used in chip development processes. And we do things that are considered a little bit bizarre, like auditing the number of flip-flops so that there isn't anything weird and unintuitive that could be created there, because it turns out that in the HDL languages that get used, often you can accidentally instantiate flip-flops that can create weird security implications. So we basically go back to working at lower levels and try to decide which levels of abstraction we have to live with and which ones we don't. But it adds a lot to the cost in terms of the engineering process. In most chip design projects, the spec development is maybe half of the effort. For us, it's about 10%. So the actual implementation and the testing of that implementation just burns a lot more person time. For a company that hires us, they're willing to spend that money. But if you're building an application that's supposed to get to market quickly, you're a startup, and you need to get some market share as fast as possible, clearly you can't do that. So I'm avoiding the question, answering the question, because I think it's unsolvable. Yeah.
Hi. Most of the successful security stories that you told today involve attacking the attacker directly, either by putting in a watermark or a serial number, finding out who it was, and taking them out by putting them in jail or turning off their device. So what do you think about the sort of philosophical implication of that, that the way we win the security game is we hurt the enemy rather than trying to deal with them in the system?
I'm not sure I would say it's fair to say that most of the examples I gave fall in that category. Certainly the academy screeners do. And I think it's a question then of looking at the particular system. So in the case of Carmen Caridi and Russell Sprague, Russell was making a lot of money pirating these things. Carmen was more of an idiot than anything else. And he got kicked out of the academy, which was a pretty significant penalty, but people that dumb probably shouldn't be in the academy. Well, I don't know. Be careful what I say here. So in that particular case, I mean, you had a guy who was criminal doing something he knew was illegal, and you can argue about whether intellectual property laws should exist in the form that they do, but given that they do exist, enforcing those laws against people who break them is not something that I would say is particularly troubling. In a situation like spam detection, there you're not really so much attacking the adversary as you're blocking the attack. So you've got a point and counterpoint type of a scenario.
But that's the stalemate. If you actually attack the attacker, you know, the people who've gone legally after the spammers, that stops that spammer.
It does. I'm not a big fan of the legal system's ability to deal with attacks that are coming from multiple sources. The RIAA and some other entities have certainly tried it. I've worked for some customers who've been trying those kinds of strategies, but technical systems work a lot better. So take the case of pay TV, for example. There have been a lot of lawsuits against individual pirates where operators would get the customer list of piracy companies and then go sue the individuals there. That's a very embarrassing and difficult kind of a process. In contrast, rolling out an effective security module that just doesn't get broken costs a lot less in terms of brand damage, and it's much faster, and it actually solves the problem. The only situations where I think going after the individual works are where you've got somebody who's got sort of small in number and deep pockets and an obligation to be good to you, but in a situation like printer consumables where you're subsidizing a printer and you want to make money off your ink cartridges, there it's actually legal to knock the things off and to make clones. So you have no opportunity to go after your adversary through a legal process. You're purely limited to technical procedures.
Hi, I'm Mike Asher from the University of Pennsylvania. I really like your idea of an arms race, or your kind of model of an arms race. And I can see from the defender's point of view, there's always the need, whether it's you work for Apache or Microsoft or Spam Assassin, to improve your software and make it more secure to prevent the next attack. But from the attacker's point of view, I'm not sure I really see it so much as an arms race, because all you need to do is get your attack through. Microsoft is an entity that's always defending their application or their operating system, but there are thousands of teenagers out there that are attackers, and all they need to do, they don't care about the arms race, they just care about whether their attack can go through. So that seems to me that it gives the attacker kind of an inherent advantage, in that they don't care about who wins the arms race, all they care about is does their attack work. And I'm wondering if you think I'm being too fatalistic, or if that's something you would agree with.
So I absolutely agree with you, and if your goal is to protect a particular computer with high-value information on it, like if you have a publicly traded company and you've got the CFO's email or the mergers and acquisition group's email, and you're trying to protect that against people who want to do illegal insider trading, that is a horrendously difficult problem, because the attacker's goal there is to get the information from a very targeted target. And the feedback is essentially missing. I mean, the only way that you'd see this kind of attack occurred, if the adversary is smart, is increased trading right before major news announcements. So that's an example where stalemate-type approaches do not work. But for sort of the ordinary user, you know, somebody who's in a real estate office with six employees who's trying to, you know, just conduct ordinary business, the vast majority of their time, their PC does work. It's not actually exploited in a way that affects them. And so as a sort of general service, their computing devices work adequately most of the time, and so long as they do backups and sort of some basic hygiene types of things, life goes on. So I think it really comes down to the question of what sort of systems are you defending, and are you looking at the highest threat individuals, or are you looking at a very broad population where you're trying to keep most of the people, i.e. most of your customer base, happy most of the time. Yeah.
Hi, Jean-Luc Giroux from Citrix. First of all, I'd like to thank you for inventing the DPA, because when I was at Jump Plus, it allowed us to grow the security team from about 10 people to 60. I had a remark about this multi-cell-like unit, approach. I was wondering how you're going to deal with how are you not going to end up in a multi-layered system? Because, let's say you have you say you're running Internet Explorer in an untrusted cell, but then somebody has to enter a password, then that will be handled by a trusted cell and lit something on the keyboard or somewhere to let the user know, okay, you can now type in your password, you've got trusted path to me or whatever. But then that has to go into Internet Explorer and things like that. Do you think that's going to be possible?
Well, the nice thing about computer security is everything is possible and almost nothing is actually going to get implemented. So since you asked me possible rather than going to happen, I will answer the question literally. And so you could certainly build a browser where, for example, passwords were managed by a separate component that had the ability to inject the appropriate bits into the stream at the appropriate location. The main application would never see the password. So you could do things like this. Now, reengineering, i.e., isn't likely to happen. On the other hand, if you have the hardware there, browsers like Firefox might start building this kind of capability. And I view it to a certain degree as a situation where we've got the transistors, so we should build the components, then see what people do with them as programmers, and build additional components to meet the additional desires and requests of the programmer base and the user base. So I don't know how it will evolve, but it is certainly possible to break down components and sandbox components where critical security tasks are running in separate hardware from the rest of the application. It just requires changing the applications, which is the hard thing to do. Yes, Steve?
Well, I would... Let me be another one to express skepticism on this point. Quite by chance, I'm in the middle of writing an essay explaining why virtual machines are not going to save us from a security perspective. They'll help, but the problem is the interactions. My browser virtual machine has to talk to my mailer virtual machine in order to handle mail to URLs. My mailer virtual machine has to open the browser virtual machine in order to let you click on URLs, and they both have to talk to the disk so you can save the things that you've received. So it will help, but it's not going to, it is very far from the panacea that some people hope it is going to be. Yes, Peter, I've started on the essay.
One way to think about the problem that maybe can give a good way to figure out where you could get a benefit or not is to imagine that you could carry as much hardware as you wanted with you.
Yep.
You could carry as many boxes and network cables, plugging them together as you wished, but what could you do with your laptop? What would you want your laptop to have in terms of this number of boxes? And if you can't make that work, adding extra components inside the chip isn't going to be fundamentally different from having them outside the chip.
That's the exact model that my essay is already assuming. with all the pieces connected by magic crypto wires that solve that problem. It's like it says on the tube of toothpaste. It's useful as part of a program of good network hygiene and regular professional software. And it will help. It's by no means a panacea. It tends to be strengthening things that operating systems can already do well, which is separating applications. The problem is the interactions. And unless we know what the policies we're trying to enforce are, putting them in separate boxes doesn't help.
I would agree with that. Peter.
You have an extraordinary record of breaking things, smart cards and whatever else. Do you have any comments you'd like to make on the trusted computing platform, Palladium, and all that sort of line of reasoning?
I'm pausing more because of political thoughts than technical ones. First of all, it's not going to solve any major problems, I don't think, because just take the question of attesting to what code got run doesn't tell you anything about the quality of the code. And from a tamper resistance perspective, the PC is just too complicated a beast to be able to lock it down. I mean, making an Intel CPU invulnerable to electromagnetic emanations between it and the memory chips. It's just not going to happen. So you're not going to have any sort of magic tamper resistance that will make the ultimate DRM, you know, lock everybody out of all content forever. So the doomsday scenarios won't happen. The magic solve all security problems clearly won't happen. The place where I see it is probably the most interesting is in corporate environments where you'd like to be able to have ordinary users have a little bit more restriction on what kinds of applications they can do and securing the boot process against the janitor. But from a sort of a hard security breaking things perspective, there's zero hope that I have that it will keep, you know, a hardware lab like ours from being able to cause malicious software to be run in PCs. And anybody who's sort of expecting that needs to get their expectations toned down. Well, yeah, it's not the most interesting of projects, perhaps, but the part of the difficulty with that particular system is that there was a huge emphasis on ensuring anonymity for the particular parts. And this sort of historically goes back to the Intel processor serial number disaster, where they sort of like they announced that they were going to put serial numbers on the engines put in their cars, and nobody was really paying attention to the fact that there are license plates sitting there like your Ethernet MAC address. And they got beaten up, I think, completely unfairly, given what everybody else was doing. But it created a requirement sort of psychologically to make sure that this wasn't something that could be used against users. So the requirement to make it completely benign watered down a lot of the security benefits that perhaps could have been obtained if you didn't have some of those restrictions in place. And for applications like web browsing, there's really nothing that you can do in the hardware that's going to make you more or less private there, since at the end of the day, it's your application that's going to make a decision as to what data goes in and out of the network. I don't think it's a waste in terms of effort, and I think a huge amount has been learned from it. But the difference between it and what I'm describing, for example, in this talk, is that it tries to take advantage of the existing CPU, the existing memory, all the existing process resources that are too complicated to secure, and then add an extra layer on top. And I'm of the opinion that the best security will be obtained by keeping all of the existing stuff, but adding something separate, and letting that new piece at least begin from scratch. It will probably get stuff piled on top of it, but at least we have Moore's Law giving us more and more transistors, so perhaps we can sort of continuously be reborn in new ways and just pile more things on, and hopefully there will be at least some components in the chip when we're all done with this process that work, and we can get the security properties that we want, or at least get something better than what we would have otherwise.
Wonderful answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If anybody's looking for a job, let me know. Thanks.